Welcome to the Books Talk podcast from Lincoln City Libraries. This program was recorded at the Gear Branch Library on October 12, 2008. In conjunction with the 2008 One Book, One Lincoln program, special guest Jim McKee relates the true story of Thomas Jefferson Fitzpatrick.
Let's see how this goes.
Pat is about to learn the definition of a new word today. Bibliophile is too small. The word is bibliomane. Okay, look that up. It's there. I see a few people that have not heard the program before. So, quite a few that have. It is a constantly evolving program. I add to it not as frequently as I used to, but I still find people who knew Thomas Jefferson Fitzpatrick or give me tidbits of information. And at some point down the line, I do intend to get it in the form of a monograph. It will be on tape, and I'm begging Pat to destroy the cassette tape which the library has downtown, which is probably 20 years old and is badly outdated, even some errors in it, so we hope to correct those as we go. This is the one program of 50 that I have that I do use notes on, and you'll see why as I get into a little bit. There are a lot of numbers, and I don't want to forget any of the numbers or get them wrong. So if you see me looking over here, it's probably to check a number. When we're all done, we'll see the pictures. The pictures are part of the story, a small part. But I should tell you before I start, as I warn everybody in this program, before I give it, I do not expect you to believe it. But maybe when you see the pictures, you will say, well, maybe a certain percentage of what he's telling me is true. We try to get it refined down, but I assure you that it is true. A difficult story to comprehend or get your arms around. Thomas Jefferson Fitzpatrick was a man I did not know. My father knew him. People who lived around me knew him. I grew up in the city of Bethany, but I did not live in Bethany. I lived in the country. My father built the second house on South Cottner Boulevard in 1940. The closest house to ours where there was anyone alive was in Bethany. We went through fields where there were deer and pheasants to get to Bethany. The first live person was on the other side of Bethany Park. So I grew up going to Bethany School. I grew up then later going to Northeast, although it was in the Lincoln High District. Our house was surrounded on all sides with corn and then wheat. So I had little to do but go to Bethany to school, Bethany Christian Church. The Boy Scout cabin, which was about one block to the south of Thomas Jefferson Fitzpatrick's house. And you would think I would have met him. I undoubtedly saw him in my life, but did not register. One person in my age group, his brother, Sonny Glass, Gene Glass's brother. Gene Glass is the great expert on Warren Isley now and comes back occasionally and does lectures. Told me stories about Thomas Jefferson Fitzpatrick and his house, which I and the rest of the guys in the Boy Scout cabin ignored. It was not the least bit interesting to us at the time. This was in the 1950s when I was growing up. The house that he lived in had two addresses. It was on the corner, 2002 North 68th, for those of you taking notes, or 6802 Lexington, just across the street and to the east from the campus of Nebraska Christian University, which became Cotner University, which became Cotner College, the name which some of you will remember even if you don't remember this school. Thomas Jefferson Fitzpatrick was born April the 2nd of 1868 in a log cabin, he could have been president, near Centerville, Iowa. He was the grandnephew of Thomas Fitzpatrick, who was a mountain man, an explorer, a man who wrote books and traveled with and helped trailsmen and railroads and so forth. He was a scout explorer. On the other side, on his mother's side, Fitzpatrick was 1/8 Creek Indian, so he had an interesting lineage on both sides, and he was a direct descendant of Thomas Jefferson, that's his name. In 1893, he got his Bachelor of Science degree at Iowa Wesleyan University, and the following year, he was made county surveyor in the county he lived in Iowa. In 1895, he completed his master's degree in science, specializing in botany, which for some peculiar reason, we know not why, was not awarded until 5 years later in 1900. Then in 1895, until 1899, he taught mathematics at Graceland College. Graceland College was formed by a dissident branch of the Mormon Church and it's clear down on the south border of Kansas in a tiny little town, and it still exists today. In fact, the college itself was organized by Joseph Smith III. He was listed in the college catalog as senior professor. In actuality, there were three members of the faculty at that time, so perhaps it wasn't too unusual. He was the first person hired at Lamoni College, and for a time, because they had to trade off, he was listed as president of the college. Obviously very small then, and it is a pretty good-sized college today, and it's still in existence. As I said, they even had campuses, satellite campuses in Kansas City, for example, and so forth. And it was at that point in his life that he began to develop an interest in Mormon, not church, but the Mormons themselves. His interest in Mormonism, if you will, centered around the fact that the Mormons, as they traveled from New York back to Illinois and down in Illinois and then ultimately over to Florence and Nebraska and through to Salt Lake City, took with them, as many migrating groups did, such as the colonies in Iowa, brought with them things like furniture making or wine making in some cases. The trade that they took with them, or one of them, was printing. And as they went west in the United States, they became, in each community that they settled in, the printer. And as the printer, they became the chronicler of history for the area. So besides printing envelopes and letterheads and the bills of lading and so forth, they also printed the history as they went. And we think that's probably what most interested Thomas Jefferson Fitzpatrick. In 1896, he married Mary Linder, many years his senior, by the way. Then from 1903 to 1907, he got the best job in the world, probably. He became a professional collector for the Iowa State Historical Society, which meant that he traveled around the countryside, encouraging people to give photographs and books and objects, ephemera and so forth, to the Iowa State Historical Society. Along the same time, of course, he was making a collection himself of Iowa history, and probably not what his contract with them would have required. In other words, he was probably not supposed to be collecting on his own. At that time, we find the first reference to his library in which he says he has about 6,000 books and 5,000 pamphlets. Just getting started. How many books are in your library, Pat? Do you have any idea? We don't know, but I don't know. The University of Nebraska's, all of its libraries put together now have just accession to 2 millionth volume, but that includes a lot of campuses and a lot of libraries. A small personal library, 6,000 and 5,000, 11,000 pieces would be a very large library at that point in time, at least. Then he went back from 1908 to 1912 and again taught at Graceland College and took over the direction of their library there. Then in 1912, he left Iowa and went to Los Angeles and became the technical reference librarian for the city of Los Angeles. Stayed there only a year. We have no idea what happened, but he went back to Nebraska, came back to Nebraska, but he didn't come to Lincoln. Instead, he came to the little village of Bethany. At that time, Bethany was a separate city and was, in fact, a separate city until 1926 when Bethany and University Place were annexed to the city of Lincoln. So we went to Bethany, and there he was teaching at Nebraska Christian University, then Cotner University. He was a professor of science, and he primarily was teaching in the School of Medicine at Cotner University. And his wife, Mary, taught at the same institution, probably mostly teaching English, we're not sure, but she was teaching as well, a pretty small college. 1917, he may have seen the handwriting on the wall. Nebraska Christian University, Cotner College, was literally bankrupt every year of its existence. It went bankrupt the first time in the 1893-1894 Depression, was teetering on the edge all the time, and finally during the Great Depression it went bankrupt again and went out of business. But in fact, it's still in business today. There's somebody trying to come in this door up here, I think. In 1917, he left and Cotner University and went to the University of Nebraska, partly because he wanted to study under Professor Bessie. Professor Bessie, and he wanted to get his doctorate there. Professor Bessie at that time was considered the most knowledgeable man of botany in the world. And it was a period of time when the University of Nebraska was hiring the absolute top of every science. If they could find a scientist anywhere in the world that was at the very pinnacle of his particular topic, his science, they would hire him. University of Nebraska was constantly in the top 3, 4, 5 universities in the United States. The only school which consistently beat them out was a university, I think it was Minnesota or Michigan, I can't remember, very bizarrely. that will change. He was known in the catalog at that time as a fellow in botany. Highest rank he ever reached was assistant professor, because he never did get his doctorate. He also became the librarian for the biology department. And as librarian in the biology department, he was well known for building their library with no budget at all. And I'll explain how he did that in a minute. By this time, he was a bibliophile. He collected primarily books of literature, fine printing, and Americana. He was particularly interested, of course, in botany and sciences. And his library at that time was listed in Who's Who as having 15,000 books. So it's doubled or trebled in size. And it's about this point in history that he stops counting or even estimating how many books there are. By 1927, someone else said 20,000, but that was strictly an outsider's guess, a man who had never seen the library, so it's pretty hard to know much about it. But 1949, Fitzpatrick retired from the University of Nebraska. 1952, he died intestate, March 28, 1952, at age 84, probably of a heart attack in the attic or the upper floor of the house. And there, our story either ends or just really begins to be building. 17 minutes, I think that may be a world's land record. It takes me 20, 25. At that time, Mary, his wife, realized that whatever of his estate she would have to live out the rest of her life on was tied up in the book collection. So she hired an attorney, a Lincoln attorney by the name of Lloyd Chapman, who represented them in a lawsuit in 1950 and had won. So he was known to them. Chapman came in, and Mary said, here's what we'll do. My suggestion is we write letters to 25 book dealers, whose addresses I have, that I know that Teddy had dealt with throughout the world and acquired books during his lifetime. So let's write them a letter inviting them to come and appraise the library. We'll sell it and hopefully have enough money for me to live out. 25 letters were written. Of the 25 letters that were written, one reply was received, and that was from Lincoln. It was from the Nebraska bookstore, and one man came out. And he came to the house, as I remember the house. And I do remember the house, because there was nothing special about the house, other than the fact that it had been completely and totally ignored as far as maintenance went. The house was a 2.5-story house originally built for a professor at Nebraska Christian University, but had been later acquired by Fitzpatrick and his wife. 2.5 stories tall, just looked like a farmhouse. White clapboard, except it wasn't white. It appeared never to have been painted. We know it had been painted because we have pictures of it when it was new. And it had been painted, but it certainly hadn't been painted again for 70-some-odd years, which in itself is not that unusual. Paint at that time was not a great preserver of wood. And Eric Sloan, who wrote books on wood, for example, at that time, said there was no evidence that it even helped preserve the wood underneath it by painting it. My grandfather built a house, had a house built for him near Havelock, probably in the early part of the 20th century, and it went several decades without being painted. And when it was finally painted, he painted it barn red, because that was the cheapest paint you could buy. I'm sure my grandmother must have been delighted. But she probably got it painted, and that was it. Roger Welsh did some research one time to figure out why barn red was cheaper than white paint, because it requires extra ingredients and so forth. And after some research, he determined that there was a reason why barn red was cheaper. It was because more people used barn red when they produced it. And why did people buy more barn red? It was because it was cheaper. Absolutely true. It was a circular argument, but that's it. So the fact that it was not painted was not unusual. The front porch of the house was completely packed solid with junk. Boxes of magazines and books, and an old stove, and lumber. He loved to collect lumber, and tree limbs, everything, just anything he could find was stacked in the front porch, to the point where the porch was not usable. He could not go through the front door, which also is not unusual for a farmhouse or an old large house out in the country. You probably have grandparents, too. You may remember back going to visit somebody in the country. You never went in the front door. Anyway, you went in the kitchen door, and the kitchen was where most people spent their time after dinner or during dinner, and they would gravitate back to the kitchen, partially because in those older houses, that's the room that was best heated. And also, just a good place to end up. In fact, if you come to dinner at our house, you're very apt to end up in the kitchen after dinner anyway for quite a while. So he found that, and he discovered he had to go around in through the door on the east side, which was the kitchen door, and he went inside. And what he saw inside is probably the reason why his bid was extremely small. The kitchen was, if you can imagine in your mind's eye, and that's kind of the fun of giving this program, and that is for you to imagine in your mind what some of these rooms look like, and then at the end we'll show you some pictures and show you some of the rooms as they actually look and see if they fit the picture you have in your mind. The kitchen, however, was kind of the last bastion, and this is where they lived their days out. Over on the east side was a breakfast nook. And I look around and I think everybody in here is probably old enough to know what a breakfast nook is. You get much younger and you know, a young person's eyes glaze over, and a breakfast nook means nothing to them. And the breakfast nook were two steel cots, and that's where they took up their end residence in there. The kitchen was a large square room. In the middle was what I call a Franklin stove. It did not light Franklin stove because he was just deathly afraid of fire, so there was no heat in the house. Hanging down from the ceiling above the stove is a light bulb, just hanging a bare light bulb. There is a piano, a piano bench, a kitchen table, several chairs, two cots, and that's the furniture in the room. Then scattered around and stacked everywhere are boxes of books, periodicals, newspapers tied up with string everywhere, to the point when you look around, you don't see the piano. It has become completely covered over with stuff. Nothing of great interest, as I said, newspapers and magazines and papers and clothing. And then, if you can imagine the room, they're just packed with stuff like this. And if you can kind of imagine taking the ceiling off the room and bringing in a dump truck load of junk and dust and dirt and rags and just letting it filter down over everything, this is the way the room looked. So it's not unusual that the bid that they got was literally nothing for the books. Well, at that point, they realized that temporarily they have no one really interested in the books at all. And as they're considering what to do, the news of Fitzpatrick's death has reached a man in Denver by the name of Malcolm Glenn, G-L-E-N-N, Wire. I believe that the Glenn in his name is a family name, perhaps his mother's maiden name, something like that. He was a former head of the University of Nebraska Library. And as such, he probably knew a little bit about Thomas Jefferson Fitzpatrick, or at least that he had a library. And at this point in time, 1952, he is the librarian emeritus of the Denver Public Library. Well, he sees that Fitzpatrick has died, and he writes a letter to a man in Kansas City whose name is Francis Glenn, G-L-E-N-N. And I've not been able to trace it down, but my feeling is that there was a relationship somehow, even if it was somewhat extended. And he told Francis Glenn to get over to Lincoln and take a look at this library, that he should make a bid on it. So Francis Glenn in Kansas City contacts Lloyd Chapman, the attorney in Lincoln, and asks permission to come up and look at the books. And of course, they were ecstatic about getting a second appraisal or a look at the books. So they invited him to come up. He came up by train, and when he came into the house, of course, he comes in through the kitchen door as well, and looks in and sees the same thing that is probably as far as the man from Nebraska book got. We don't know, because we don't know who it was. Nobody will admit it. All of us who ultimately worked at Nebraska Book or had a relation with Nebraska Book have a couple of pretty good ideas. We have, you know, it really had to be one of less than half a dozen people, but no one will admit it, reasonably so. But Francis Glenn has invested in the price of a railroad ticket to come up all the way from Kansas City. So although he's off-put, perhaps, by the kitchen for junk, he, like anyone who buys book collections, knows that there's always more than you see immediately. And one of the questions usually is, if you see a collection of books and it's not too startling, you always say, where's the stuff you're going to throw away? And that's sometimes where the good stuff is. Because most people who have a collection of books thinks, here's a Bible that's not only really, really old, But it's even written in German. That's got to be the most valuable part. Well, that's the thing that's worth nothing. And the pamphlets and the stuff that are out in the back that are being thrown away in the chicken coop or whatever, that's sometimes the best part of all. So he did the one thing that the Nebraska Book Man probably didn't do, and he opened the door, which went from the kitchen into what had been the dining room. Now, when he opened the door into that room, he saw a room full of books. Okay. Now make, in your mind, take a snapshot of what you think a room full of books is. And then most people come up with a room. It would be smaller than this room, but a rectangle. And it would have bookshelves from the floor to the ceiling on all the walls, full of books. And if they're small books, they would be pushed to the back and another row of books in front. And then if you collect books at all, you know that then the top of the books and the bottom of the shelf above it, there's always a little room. So you can fill that in with books laying horizontally. And then, I like it, a nice easy chair sitting over on one side and a gooseneck lamp and the library table. And the library table will be stacked with books. There will be books under the library table. There will be stacks of books beside the chair. There will be books stacked all over on the floor everywhere. Books everywhere. And that's what most people think a room full of books is. But that is not a room full of books. That is a room with some books. Now, let's start over with the room. And let's take on the south side, where there is what we today would call a picture window. It's just a large window. And since we're going to have to cover that, we're going to board over that right away. Now we have a vanilla box. A box which has a door at one end leading to the kitchen, and a door on the other end which leads into the hallway. Now we're going to start along one wall. Let's start along the south wall just for fun. And we're going to lay books along the bottom with the spines in so we can read them. And then we'll stack books from the floor clear to the ceiling, all spine in. So we'll have a wall of books spine in. Then we'll go to the opposite wall, the north wall, and we'll do the same thing. Okay, now we have to go back over to the other wall and build another row of books inside that row. And then back to the north side and build another one until these walls of books come in to about 36 inches. Now, if you know anything about books, and if you work in Nebraska Book, you'll know that books don't like to be stacked much above this because the spine is slightly thicker than the foredge. So they want to kind of come in. So when you get up to about 6 feet, what you need to do is, as you're stacking these books, put a plank out. See? And then stack books on top of that, and this will hold the books back. I find a 1x12 works pretty well. This will hold the books out against the wall. Okay. But if you use all these 1x12s to hold the books out, what have you done? You've built a bookshelf. You know, many of them through the room. So now you can stack books on the 1x12 from 6 feet up to the ceiling. So now when you open the door to a room full of books, what do you see? Nothing. You can't see anything. It's dark. You just see sort of a tunnel. And you have no idea what's there. And this is what Francis Glenn saw. And he knew immediately that the only way to find out what was in there was to unpack the books from the room. So he began taking the books out and putting them in the kitchen and watching as he went. He spent all one day doing that. And we don't know how much more time. But one day in doing that, he said he found, for example, 500 volumes of Abraham Lincoln's personal library. He discovered a Raffinesque library. Raffinesque was a botanist who lived from 1783 till 1840. And the largest collection of Raffinesque books, materials, and so forth in the world was at the Library of Congress. They had 46 items. In the house in Bethany, Nebraska, Thomas Jefferson Fitzpatrick had 941 individual items, including 16 original manuscripts belonging to Raffinesque. They discovered the largest collection of Mormon books in the world, period. Larger than the books owned by the Mormon Church. And when I first wrote about this in Nebraska Library Quarterly, gosh, it would have been back in the late 70s, I think, maybe early 80s. Days after it appeared, I got a call from the Mormon library who had questions about it. They knew about the library, but they had some questions, and unfortunately none of them could I answer. Discovered lots of things. Discovered holographic, in other words, handwritten copy of the Emancipation Proclamation, written in Abraham Lincoln's own hand, in other words. Books on the American Indian, Civil War, Masonry, History, Science. 321 volumes of what was known as the Linnaean Library. Now, Linnaeus was another botanist. And Linnaean, the Linnaean Library, had been sold decades before. It had been sold out of Sweden to someone in Great Britain. And when the King of Sweden learned that this very valuable library, and Linnaeus was the first person to use microscope, for example, and one of the books in there we'll talk about later was the first book to explain the use of the microscope. When the King of Sweden learned that the library had been sold into England, he said he couldn't let that happen. So he set out some troops to recapture the library and learned that it had not only already been put on a ship, but the ship had set sail. So he sent the Navy, the Swedish Navy, after it to capture the library and return it to Sweden. But unfortunately, high seas got in between him, and they were unable to. The library did end up in Britain. And this portion of it, 321 volumes, ended up in Bethany, Nebraska. In 1950, Fitzpatrick had sold a portion of this library to the University of Nebraska for $500. So 321 volumes were the excess of what he had accumulated through the years. They discovered the largest collection of Iowa history books in private hands, in other words, outside of the Iowa State Historical Society. We know where those came from, don't we? He discovered signatures of all the signers of the Declaration of Independence. We don't know if he had Button in that, but it was said it was the largest, or that he had the signers of all the signers, so maybe he did. Discovered Thomas Jefferson's violin, 40 volumes from Thomas Jefferson's library. And this is where Pat Sloan, as a librarian, should sit up and say, wait a minute, Thomas Jefferson didn't have a library. He sold it to the United States to become the basis of the Library of Congress, his whole library. But you got to remember, he lived for a while after that. And a man who has amassed a large library and is a great reader certainly is going to continue to obtain books at that point in his life. And so those volumes came down to him, probably through inheritance. We have no direct way of knowing, but probably that's how they came down to him. Well, Francis Glenn, in his zeal in getting through this one room of the house, forgot two things. The first thing he forgot was that the house was unheated and it was very, very cold. In fact, he will frostbite his left hand so badly that he will never regain use of it. But he didn't care. He's literally found that one collection, that one thing that every book dealer in the world through his entire life would look for, but never found. But he's found it. The other thing he forgot at the end of that first period is that this is a 13-room house. And he has seen the kitchen and the dining room. Before he leaves that night, he decides to make a circuit of the other 11 rooms in the house. And before you think I'm going to tell you all of them were full of books, you're wrong. One of them was not. And that was a bedroom up on the second floor, not used as a bedroom, but rather a room which in the middle of it had a large printing press. And he had to be able to walk around that printing press. So, in effect, the other rooms were all full of books. Well, Francis Glenn ultimately is going to get through the house, and he's going to make an offer for the books of around $30,000. We don't know at that point exactly what his offer was. But he did tell them, and here's where we first find out some things about Lloyd Chapman, the attorney. He said, "Now I'm offering $30,000 for the books, but I'm going to take about 10% of them. That's all I want. And I'm going to leave you with 90% of them," which Lloyd Chapman thought, whoa, whoa, I'm going to sell 10% of them for $30,000. I'm going to keep 90% of them. In other words, I've got 90% to go. They'll be worth, you know, many times more. But what Lloyd Chapman somehow didn't take into account was that any collection, anything that has value, if you take 10% of it out, you're going to take out 98% of the value. And what's going to be left is worth probably little or nothing. But he doesn't seem to understand that. So he's pretty delighted with the offer. And so away the books go. He comes in, and the first thing he's going to have to do is, in order to get him out of the house, is he's going to hire a Lincoln engineer. Because his question is, how do I get the books out of the house? And the engineer goes in, and his bill is in the estate papers. So we know that the engineer came in. We know that he advised him on how to get the books out. And basically, his advice was one sentence. Start at the top. Pretty good. He didn't get a lot of money for that, but he did get paid for doing that. And away went the books. Well, the books then went to Kansas City. Now, the big problem that Francis Glenn has at this point in time is he has to write a check for $30,000 to the estate, Thomas Jefferson Fitzpatrick, the $30,000 which he does not have. So he gets back to Kansas City and he contacts two institutions. Kansas City Public Library, he contacts and says, here's what I want to do. I want to sell you 1,000 volumes of poetry, the Lincoln Library, the Jefferson Library, the Iowa History, and the Mormon collection for $35,000. Then he goes to the University of Kansas, the Spencer Research Library is where they ended up, and he says, I want to sell you the science books for $35,000. Okay. Are you quick with math? Now, he's turned a tight little profit already. Now he gets them back to Kansas City, and of course he has to rent warehouses because he's going to have to sort these books out. The science books got to go over here for Spencer Library at Lawrence, and the others that I mentioned have to go to Kansas City. And there's going to be a lot of books left over in the middle that he's going to keep. So he has to start sorting them out. And as he sorts, one of the things he notices almost at once is that in each one of the collections, let's say Iowa History, for example, there are holes within that collection of books that should be there, but aren't there. Some of them not necessarily rare books, some of them rare books, but you know, when you have a collection that is this big and this good, there are going to be certain books that are going to be there. And he noticed these holes in every one of the disciplines. So he calls Mary. Now Mary at this time is living with her sister on a farm near Iowa City. Unfortunately, Mary has fallen over a stack of books and has broken her hip. Now, certainly for a bibliophile, that's the way to go. But on the other hand, back in the 50s, when a person nearing 90 breaks their hip, it's literally a death warrant. So she's back living with her sister and realizing that she probably doesn't have a lot of time left, but she's got a great sense of humor. And then she begins listening to Francis Glenn, who says, there are holes in each one of the collections. So his first question probably is, was Fitzpatrick a loaner of books? She says, oh my, yes, he loaned books all the time, every day, all over the world, people would write him for books. And he always mailed them off. She said, I see what you're getting at. You're thinking that the books that are missing, someone has borrowed them. She said, well, probably not. Or if they have been, we can't worry about it. She says, enough time has gone by now that, you know, if he loaned them to somebody in a foreign country, they may not know he's died. He's loaned them to some professor off somewhere that may not remember where he got them. They've loaned them to some professor off somewhere who knows where he got them, but knows that Fitzpatrick is dead and knows that there's a record, and they're on his shelf because, as you know, when you loan a book to someone, you have given them that book. She said, so here's what I think. She said, I think that whatever you've got, that's what we're going to have to go with. Just ignore anything that's out there. We know that he was getting books back all the time, the library was. We'll just have to say whatever's there, that's the collection we're going to go with. But Francis Glenn was not willing to accept this. He said, no, this is not a good answer. Because, in fact, some of the books that aren't there are common books that would be in any university library in the United States. No one would write from anywhere to borrow a book of someone that were missing. He said, and they would be there. You know, they're staple, positive items. If you collect Nebraska history, you're going to have Andreas' History of Nebraska, 1882. You're going to. Everybody's going to have it. And some books like that, they just weren't there. So he said, you know, they've got to be someplace. Well, she said, now, I understand you took 10% of the books. The tip of the iceberg, he called it. Took 10% of the books back to Kansas City. That means you left 90% of the books in Lincoln. So the books, she's thinking, the books that you're looking for that aren't there, you've left in Lincoln. So she asked the next obvious question. She said, well, which books did you look at? He said, well, I looked at all the books. She said, no, which books did you really look at? He says, well, I really looked at all the books. No, which books did you actually carefully examine? He said, I carefully examined all of the books. Look, he said, I took 10% of them, but I looked at all of them. She said, no, I don't think you understand what I'm saying. Which of the books did you actually get into? Because I think her thinking at this point was, for example, if a book has 10 plates or maps in it, and if one of those plates is missing, 1 out of 10, that book is worth 50% of what it would have been. If two are missing, 50% of the 50%. So Francis Galen, probably in an attempt to stop the conversation at this point, says no. Explains to her about the match. He said, we vetted every single book in the house. I looked at them all. I took the 10% I wanted that I knew I could sell. The other 90% are there. I looked at every single book in the house. That is what Mary was waiting for. That's what I meant, she said. Which house? So, what turns out is, before they moved into this house in the corner, they had lived in what they called a cottage, which is a tiny little house next door. They lived in there, and then they had bought the house, the big house in the corner that everybody knew about. So, there's more books. Now, at this point, Francis Glenn is going to come back to Lincoln. But this time, he's going to bring with him the director of the Kansas City Public and the director of the University of Kansas Library, because he wants them to see what's left. And these two gentlemen write an article for the, the National Library Journal. Maybe that's it, the Library Journal. And that's been published. And they took careful notes. So these things are pretty well nailed down. They coming back on the train with Francis Glenn from Kansas City. Between the two of them, they have been speculating. They apparently know that Francis Glenn is capable of just a little bit of embroidery, making things a little bigger than they were. So they're estimating that probably his numbers and so forth are, they're saying, 8 to 10 times more than actually existed. But they said when they got to the cottage and they opened the door and saw that they couldn't go in, that he had packed his way out of the house, he said they realized for the first time that, in fact, the numbers were so huge that a book dealer would never have been able to deal with this kind of numbers. The numbers didn't mean anything. And if anything, he had underestimated the numbers of books. So he makes them the same arrangement. Will each of them take a certain part of the collections? They agree. And again, the books are loaded up in vans and taken back to Kansas City. At this point, let me see if I can find the numbers here. 90 tons of books they took. 4 semi-trailer truckloads. About 500,000 books. If you count pamphlets, probably 750,000 books and pamphlets. 10% of the collection. Back to Kansas City it goes. Now he's going to start sorting them out. As he sorts, those holes that were there slowly fill up. But they don't fill up. The holes are still there. They're just much, much smaller now. And they're called American. And he says, well, there's got to be more books. And Mary starts, she probably laughs. She seems to have a great sense of humor. She probably laughs. And she says, yeah, you want me to tell you there's another house? She said, but there isn't. There isn't. Well, Francis Glenn is not going to accept that. He's learned the first time not to just let things lie. So he pushes it. He says, there have to be more books. Where could they be? And she said, well, there could be a few. She said, as we traveled around Los Angeles, around in Iowa, and back to Bethany, of course, Teddy continued to buy books. And as he bought books, he would sometimes send them down here to my sister's house in Iowa City. And she stored them away in the barn. Now, the problem is, her sister's husband had died long ago, and there was a tenant farmer who didn't use the barn. And she said, so the books, if there are any, and I have no reason to believe there are, but if there are any, they have been sitting out in that barn, which hasn't been opened for decades. The roof's gone. You know, they would be wet. There would be vermin. There would be bugs. She said, I doubt that even if there's anything there, because these books are going to have a lot of leather bindings, that there would be anything salvageable. And Mary said, I'll tell you what. You've been very, very good to us. If there's anything in that barn, it's yours. You can have it. 12 seconds later, Francis Glenn was on the train, headed for Iowa City. Now, what did he find in the barn? Do you suppose when he opened the door? You already know, don't you? The barn was full of books. So tightly packed that they were in perfect condition. Tightly packed. You know, you couldn't get bugs and dirt and vermin into them. Maybe the ones on top had gotten wet, but they were all okay. For the most part. Also, in the attic of the sister's house, they discovered full of books. For example,
a complete set of the congressional record, including the credit congressional record before it was known as the congressional record, all the way back. And Mary laughed, and she said, oh yeah, I forgot about those. She said, sometimes if Teddy couldn't get to sleep at night, he would pick up a copy of the congressional record. And that would do it every time. He would do it.
The books went back to Kansas City, and sure enough, the holes all filled in. The library is done, all completed. Moves the books. Now, from here on in, I'm going to skip around, just because it's a little easier. When Francis Glenn comes back, and he's walking through the house with Lloyd Chapman, the attorney, who obviously is going to go with him, they're chatting, and they're up in what we would call the attic, which would be the third floor of the house, except it was a 2.5-story house. And the attic was finished. In other words, it had a floor. And in that room, they're walking around, and of course, it's full of stuff. And as they go through the attic, chimney comes up through the floor, through the roof, and out. Brick chimney, of course. And this chimney would have been there for a long time, you know, 70, 75 years. And a chimney of brick, when a house was built like that, they would build a brick chimney, then they would stucco over it, probably cement or something, so it would be smooth. But a chimney like that would not have had much of a liner or anything else. So as it's heated in the winter, heating, cooling, expanding, contracting, through many years, that concrete would just begin to fall down around it like dust, and it would all come down. It was around the chimney, there was just a dust, accumulated concrete dust and so forth. And Francis Glenn is over there kicking in the dust, and he discovers two stacks of magazines, sort of things, pamphlets, tied up with string. And what they turn out to be was the Saints' Herald, which is the earliest publications of the Mormon Church. Four bundles of them, the only copies known anywhere in the world, the Saints. Now, at that time, the University of Nebraska, where he is the librarian, had discovered that Fitzgerald had taken down to the university about 20,000 volumes of his library and had intermingled them with the university's books. And so they tried to go through the collection and return to the estate of those books that they knew weren't theirs. So they had gotten back. Now the estate was ultimately to receive $53,000 on the book sale. But another thing that Francis Glenn noticed as he went through this attic of the house was down towards the west end, probably under kind of a gable, was a, we would call it a closet, but it would have been probably, you know, 12 foot by 12 foot, something like that. And on each side were big, like bins, not shelves, but bins, where they would have, and these were built into houses at that time, where they would have stored what they called sheet blankets. These would be, in the summertime, you'd take these heavy flannel sheets and so forth off and you would store them up there. This room was, interestingly, not full of books, but rather on the floor, there were several stacks of newspapers opened out flat, about maybe 4 feet tall. So immediately, Chapman says, this must be the newspaper collection. And he said, nope, it's just newspapers. There's new newspapers, old newspapers, there's Lincoln newspapers, there's New York newspapers. It's just newspapers. He saved newspapers. And he said, so those will just have to go to the dump, because there's nothing there. So, the estate papers, which I've got copies of, show that they hire someone to come from the salvage paper people to look at them. And they buy all of the newspapers and magazines to be recycled. You know, recycling, even in 1952. Mm-hmm. And they bought 65 ton of magazines and newspapers to be recycled. They wouldn't touch the newspapers up in the top room. And I always figured, well, because it wouldn't be easy to get them out of there. But I read further and I say, no, that's not the case at all. For example, what they do is they bring dump trucks up and they round the house and they just shovel the stuff out into there. Now, when all of the books are out of the house that they're wanted in Kansas City and they discover to their dismay that the other 90% aren't worth anything, Long's Bookstore, remember them? Long's, Mr. Long, is invited in. Ernest, this would be Ernie's father. Ernest is invited in and told that he can buy anything he wants for 1.25 cents apiece. And he told me he bought as many books as he could store, and then he quit. And then the rest of them went with the newspapers that weren't saleable to the dump. And at that time, they couldn't salvage. They couldn't recycle books because they could not get a hardbound book, for example. It has glue, and you couldn't recycle it. Now, what they could do, they were sending books out to the penitentiary with a drop leaf. They could cut off the spine in the hardback books, but it wasn't economically viable. So those books went to the dump, 79 dump truckloads full books went to the dump. Later on, we know of a man, Professor Milan Stout, who's still with us. As far as I know, he came to the last time I gave the lecture, and I've talked to him over the years many times. Milan has got to be his 90s, and 2 years ago, he was still driving, which is kind of a scary thing. But at any rate, he's pretty sharp, and he told me that when I mentioned this to him, he said, well, this newspaper's up, and he says, yeah, I know what that was. And he said, and also now why they couldn't buy them, it wasn't because they were on the third floor, it was because when the guy from the salvage paper place went up, he picked up the top newspaper. And there was weeds, he said. Look, he said, there's a newspaper, and there's weeds. There's a newspaper, and there's weeds. He said, this isn't going to be worth our time to separate the weeds from the newspapers. Off to the dump they went. Milan Stout said, that was his private herbarium. He says, now, in the 1950s and 60s, he said, at that time, that late after his death, the university was still getting a request, weekly or monthly, from someone, some far-flung place in the world, wanting from Fitzpatrick a specimen of a seed or leaf of a plant which had been extinct, some of them for hundreds and hundreds, or if not a thousand years. The only known specimens in the world were in his herbarium. And he said, now, we'll just have to tell them they're gone. So, we're at the dump. I look at my notes. What else could there be more? Stout knew Fitzpatrick, and he knew that the library was known all around the world. And he also knew that the university had missed the chance of getting the library. But he contacted then Francis Glenn in Kansas City and found out that there were a goodly number of science books left that were duplicates and stuff that Glenn had kept and was selling off that hadn't gone to the University of Kansas. So Stout got permission to come down and look at the books that were left. And he went, and with Glenn went first. He said, well, first go to my house and I'll show you the one book I have for which I will get $1 million. This is in 1950s, 52, 53, 54, somewhere in there when Stout went down there. And there were no books worth much more than $100. You could buy a first folio for $100,000. An Audubon elephant folio for $100,000. So to think that he thought a book was $1 million, that was, frankly, probably impossible. But at any rate, that's what he said. Here's a book which I'll get $1 million. And he took him into the vault that he had in his home. And Professor Stout said, what he told me it was, and I did not look at it to know, it was a diary. And he said, it is Joseph Smith's diary, his handwritten diary, in which he explains how he falsified the religion, invented the tablets, hired somebody to write the language, and he said, for this, I will get $1 million. Well, there's an awful lot of anti-Mormon books out there, about as many anti-Mormon books as there are Mormon books, and Stout didn't really give it any credence at all, didn't look at it. You know, how do you know? What is it? Just, it's nothing. He wasn't interested in that anyway. What he was interested in, the fact, for example, there were Newton's Principia Mathematica. There were about a dozen copies of Newton's Principia Mathematica. At that point in time, they were worth about $50,000 apiece. There were a dozen of them. So he came back to Lincoln, and he asked Perry Branch, who was setting up the University of Nebraska Foundation, to quick like a bunny, because Glenn tells him that he will take $51,000 for all of the science books that are left. And so he says to Perry Branch, you know, get a letter out. We just need to raise $51,000. And a sample of Perry Branch's letter is in the archives at the University of Nebraska. You know, he writes around and he gets a few thousand dollars. He doesn't. And it's obvious that he nor anybody else probably around here knew how to ask for money for old books. It's just not very glamorous. So it just got forgotten and they didn't get them. Today, the Principia Mathematica, the first editions go for around $500,000. The second edition is for around $32,000. That's just one title that they could have gotten. And Stout knew that if they could get them, they could keep a couple of the books for the library, sell off the rest, and make a nice profit. But they didn't get them. The Linnaeum items, some of them, and the university cabinet, we know that. He also asked Chancellor Gustafson to look at the books, to consider buying the remainders, and Gustafson later was reprinted in the obituary in the Lincoln paper, Lincoln Star. Gustafson and the head librarian at that time said they were uninterested in old books. They needed books that were current books. And this is a justifiable argument, by the way. The students and the faculty aren't interested in rare and collectible books. They want the cutting edge of science. And he said, we had money for bread, but not for cake. That was his quote. I'm sure he had time to think about that before he said it. But it shows how short-sighted one can be. Money was not available. The other thing that then at this point, Stout thinks, well, if I'm not going to get it from the University Foundation, what I need to do is I need to find somebody myself who can get into his pocket, whip out his checkbook, and write a check for $51,000. And son of a gun, Stout knew just exactly the right person. His name was Professor Schramm, Schramm State Park. Okay, and he owned farms all over, Schramm did. And Schramm was a professor at the university, they had a campus, and he lived in the YMCA, so he wasn't well known for just losing money in the back of the sofa. So Stout and his wife went over to the YMCA, picked up Schramm, and took him down to Kansas City to see the books. They looked at the books, and he said, as Schramm looked at the books, he said he could see several times that he was just on the verge of reaching for that checkbook, but he never did. He wouldn't buy them either. He wasn't interested. So they didn't get them again, and everything is gone. Stout said, when I retired, one of the things I wanted to do was, he said, I suddenly realized that, what could there have been in that Joseph Smith diary? So he realized that it had been sold, but for how much, we don't know. Certainly not $1 million. Probably. You know, if you got $20,000 worth, it'd be a princely sum of money for something like that. And it went back to either Yale or Princeton, I forget. And that university printed several copies up. I think they printed, I've got that number here someplace. I think they printed 100 copies. But all of the major research libraries in the United States got a thousand copies. So there was the original and 1,000 reprints. And they scattered them all over university libraries and research libraries all over the United States. In fact, the card catalog showed there was one in the University of Nebraska's library. So Stout said, just for fun, I'm going to now go in retirement, and I'm going to read that book and see if there was anything there. Well, they went down to the University of Nebraska library, and son of a gun, guess what? It was missing. It wasn't there. So that's easy. And in a library alone, 1,001 copies. 1,001 copies. Every single one of them was missing. Every single one of them. Now we'll never know. Who knows? We don't know. We do know that there were factions within the Mormon Church who were buying these anti-Mormon books and destroying them. The Mormon Church, to their credit, did not do that. They acquired the anti-Mormon books and they stored them away. They kept them. They did not destroy them. And they didn't have a copy of it. So, who knows? Well, let's see. There was a copy of Hooke's Micrographia, 1667, which is the first book to describe the use of the microscope. And he had given a copy of that to the University of Nebraska. And when they went to return that, as they were culling out the collection, the library, which was then taken care of by Fitzpatrick's son, he said, no, I'll tell you what, there's still a copy of that book in the library here, so the University of Nebraska can keep that copy. And they still have it. And if you look in the card catalog, you'll see it is ex-library Thomas Jefferson Fitzpatrick. I have no idea. There were 12 copies of that book known. Fitzpatrick owned two of them, one which stayed in his collection and one which he gave the University of Nebraska. I have been unable to put a price on it. One hasn't gone up for auction in even recent history. A second edition is worth about $12,000, and both of these were first editions, so I have no idea. Can't even guess. As people dealt with Fitzpatrick all over the world, book dealers, they all thought they were dealing with a multimillionaire. They just assumed, because if he wanted a book, he would say, how much is it? And he would buy it. Never haggled. He just took it.
as I talked to Francis Glenn's wife, artist Glenn, which kind of interestingly I met when she came back to Lincoln to buy another library, Johnny Johnson's library, after his death. And I got to interview her. And I said, you know, this must have been really something interesting to work with. When you think of all the books that he had, that obviously he couldn't have read, he couldn't have known what he had. It's kind of sad to think that he just kept collecting. And she said, well, now wait a minute. She said, now you know that we only took a small percentage of the books. But as we did, we vetted them. As I said, they had to look and see if all the plates were there and so forth. She said, every single book we bought, in the front, on the title page, in lead pencil, there was an annotation made. First of all, if the book was complete, all the pages were there, it would say complete, TJF, this colophon. It would then say how much he paid for the book, where he bought it, how much postage was on the package, and what that book was going for sale at other places. She said, every single book. Also back then, there was no such thing as spell check. And when a book came out, they were loaded with errors. And you've seen people, maybe in your memory, that would see an error, like in Time magazine, the word the would be spelled T-E-H, and they would correct it over the margin. She said, every single book had corrections all the way through. Every single book that we bought. And she said, we're not talking about, 10,000 or 20,000 books. We're talking about hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of books. I said, well, how is that possible? It seems to me that evidently it must have been. We know that his wife was helping him with this. She was helping him with it. He had a son and a daughter. Maybe they were helping him out. We actually found the lady who helped them put together the herbarium. And although her name slips my mind, she went to First Plymouth Congregational Church, and I met her. I've got it written down someplace. She was hired by the WPA to go out and help him put together the herbarium. And she tells a story about how it was put together. When I talked to Professor Stout the first time, and I told him what I knew, and I said, now tell me some stories. And he said, well, let me tell you about the first time I met Fitzy. His wife called him Teddy, people downtown called him Fitzy. Okay? So I said, when I first met Fitzy, it was at the university library when he was the librarian for the biology department. And he said what he had done was he had sent memos to everybody in all the disciplines all across the university system and said, if you have duplicates, send them over to me. And then I will use them to trade to build up the biology and botany library. So that's how he built it without any university money going into it. He got all these people to give him all these books and he would trade them, constantly trade them. So he said, I had a student who was working on his doctoral thesis. And he said he needed a book. And he told me what the book was, but I don't remember. And it was something like U.S. Pharmacopoeia, a GPO publication. But they didn't have it in the regular library catalog. So he said, I went down to the library with the student to see if there was a copy in his library at home. And he said, the library, the biology department, was just like you think it was. It was shambles. He said, but he knew where every single thing was. He said, for example, there was a stack of GovDocs. Government documents, pamphlets from the Department of Agriculture, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. He said you could ask him for volume 17, number 31 of the U.S. Department of Agriculture bulletin on grub worms, and he'd just go, just pull it out. He knew where it was. He said, so we went down and we asked him about this particular book. And he said, yeah. He said, I do have a copy of that. He said, yeah. Just a minute. He said, I bought it from Howell's Book Company in San Francisco. 1922 for $20. He says, you come out to the house tonight and I'll loan it to your student. Stout says, I went out to the house. He said, first of all, let me tell you, you're wrong. That's not how the house looked. This is the 1920s. He said, it didn't look like it ever been painted, and I did have to go through the kitchen door. He said, but it wasn't loaded up with junk and stuff. He said, the first thing that impressed me was that the door was held closed by a 10-penny nail that you just turned out of the way. He said, and I went into the kitchen, and it wasn't like you said it was. It was just a proper, clean kitchen at that time. Remember, this is 30-some years previous. And he said, he went over to the breakfast nook. And he said, there were no cots in the breakfast nook. It was a breakfast nook. He said, but there was a shelf up around the top. And on it was a row of scribble books, which didn't mean anything to me, but I found out by pressing him that those were big cheap tablets. Remember, these cost a nickel and they were on newsprint, remember? He said this was his indexing system. And he said he went over and he ran his fingers down, he found one, pulled it on, flipped through it, and said, ah, here it is, here it is. It says, Howell's Book Company, 1922, $30. He'd forgotten how much he paid for it. He said, wait here, I'll go up and get it. He said, I wasn't out of the rest of the house. Never was. He said, stuck it back up. He went off. I was talking to Mary. A little while later, he came down with the book. I took the book away with me, loaned it to the student. The student wrote a dissertation. And at that time, if he had not been able to get that book, the student would have had two choices. He could have gone to Washington, D.C. to the Library of Congress, where the other known copy was, and he could have worked with it. Or he could have hired an amanuensis, which was perfectly legal, somebody to go and do the research for him. So this is a pretty good deal for the student. He said, I took the book back to Fitzy in the library and then never thought about it again. I was never in the house again until after he was dead. He says, and at that time, I went with Lloyd Chapman. The books were all out of the house. The house was empty. And he said, I went out because I knew about that printing press up on the second floor, and I wanted it for the biology department. He said, I wanted it to print labels for the herbarium. He says, so I went out, and Chapman said, if you want it, you can have it for $37. That's the value of the scrap metal. But you have to move it. And it was one of those that had a great big flywheel on the side. Big, it must have weighed about like a 57 Buick. And it was on the second floor of the house. So they had to hire Sullivan's Moving. Come in and get this press and take it out. He says, there I am with him talking about the state. He said, I asked Chapman, this must have been just phenomenal to work with all this. He said, Chapman admitted he didn't have a clue. Never understood it. Never had a clue. And it's obvious. He didn't have any idea what he was working with from any point of view. Well, here are all these books with all these little notations in them. So I said to Mrs. Lynn, just think of it. He, his wife, his two kids, and whoever else they could get from the WP or anything, they spent literally every waking hour, apparently, looking at these books, writing in the margins, correcting them. So it just flabbergasting. How could he even slept, let alone have two children? He must have done nothing else. And yet, when I read his obituary in the Kansas City Star, which was almost a advertisement for Glenn's bookstore, if you look at it carefully, I discovered that he was a member of a lot of clubs, a lot of clubs. For example, the Baconian, the Ridgeway, the Sigma Xi, Delta Sigma Phi, the Masons, the Knights Templar, IOOF. The American Association of Science, the Iowa Academy of Science, Botanical, on and on and on and on and on and on. And I said, well, he's one of those guys that is a member of everything. You know, they come to the door, ding dong, join up. Yeah, sure, I'll join. And then, you know, he's a member, but that's it. He said, you know, not active. And he said, oh, no, well, wait a minute. He said, a lot of those are university. He was active. He was a member. He was an officer in a lot of those. He went to the meetings. Wow, okay. So, he spent every waking moment either writing in these books, reading these books, or going to meetings. When did he have time to work at the library? He couldn't have had time to do anything else. Then I discovered that he wrote 12 books and over 200 technical articles in journals that had been published. In fact, of the 12 books that had been published, he couldn't find a publisher for all of them. So he formed what he called the Enterprise Publishing Company. He published them. He printed them. Up there on the second floor of the house, and disseminated them all over the world. 12 books and 200 articles. The Enterprise Publishing Company. One of the people I interviewed was a member by the name of Dave Schaefer. Where's my lady from Bethany? Remember Dave Schaefer? He was a mailman. So I talked to Dave, and he said, you know, tell me about it. He said, well, first thing I would say is, he said, I had to retire early from the post office because my back went out. And I said, taking books to Fitzpatrick. And he said, oh, no. He said, I didn't have to take him his mail. That truck came from the post office every day. I said, well, tell me another story. He said, okay. Well, I said, towards the end of his life, when he became a little disjointed, maybe the collecting had sort of taken over a little bit. Speaking as a bookseller, I don't see how that's possible. But he said he began collecting other things. Ernest Long, Ernie's father, had told me he loved payday at the University of Nebraska. They'd get paid, and here would come Fitzpatrick. And he would range through the stores. He started out at the nickel and dime, then he'd range through the whole store until he had as many books as he could carry. Sometimes all the money he had, he would spend on books. Get home, get all these books. He said, I loved it. And one of the letters that's in the archives down there is a letter from Fitzpatrick to Mary when she's off visiting her sister in Iowa City. And this is one of the reasons I know they both had a pretty good sense of humor. He tells her about having gone to the university, gotten paid, and headed back home. And by the time he got home, he bought some new books. He said, all I had money left for the week was my groceries. I went to Armstrong's Market. And he said, all I had money left for was to buy a lemon pie. Then I got home and discovered, guess what? I didn't know. I'm allergic to citrus food. So I think he had a pretty good sense of humor. Mary must have thought so, too. Just to put up with him that long is certainly worth something. His son Fred became the chairman of the biology department at Columbia University. Daughter, Lillian, wrote a book which, to my knowledge, is still in print today, and probably you could go out and look on the shelf here and find it. It was the predecessor of Perkey's Nebraska's Place Names, and it was just called Nebraska Place Names by Lillian Fitzpatrick. But Lillian contracted tuberculosis, and as her health became more fragile, she realized, and the idea for the book had been given to her by her father. Fred Link had written the original book, and said, this needs to be brought up to date, Lillian, so this is something you should do. And she realized she wasn't going to get it done. So her father didn't have anything else to do. She asked him to finish it for her. And if you look at the book today on the shelves out here, and it's, like I said, still in print as far as I know, in the introduction, she thanks her father for finishing the book for her. And then signs it. Lillian Fitzpatrick, Bethany, Nebraska, 1913. Still there. So he had time to do a few things like that.
The receipts from the estate totaled $53,125.15. That wasn't all from the books, because the personal property was $100. The two houses sold for $2,500. And it's noted on the estate papers that only one of the houses had electricity. There was a 1937 Lincoln Zephyr with a cracked block. They got $290 for. Then the estate charged him $6,708.65 and attorney's fees $12,509, meaning that the net to Mary on July the 29th, 1953, $33,307.20. Not much, but enough at that point in time. Another lady I talked to was Mrs. Marjorie Matson Smith. Remember Siegel Matson?
No.
Okay. Marjorie lived two doors down, and she was, by the time I interviewed her, probably 10 years ago, she was in her 90s, and she had been the choir director and organist at Second Presbyterian Church, I think it was. It was at 26th and P. And she said, I used to go over and visit the Fitzpatricks, and I would I'd love to talk to Mary. She said she was just a delightful lady, and we would talk, and they had records, and we would listen to records. And she said sometimes I would take them down to Bethany Church, and I would play the organ for them, and they loved the organ music. Jack Critchfield was their electric meter reader man I interviewed, and asked him to tell me a story. He said, well, the best story that I can tell you is Fitzpatrick, one day I got from my boss, said, you know, we need to get out there to this house in Bethany, the Fitzpatrick house. You need to get a meter reading. He said, because we haven't had a meter reading for years. We've been giving him an estimated billing, and you need to get out there and get a meter reading. So Jack said, I went out there, and I discovered right away that the meter wasn't on the outside of the house. That's why there hadn't been any meter readings taken. He said, it was inside the house. And he said, it was in the bathroom, which historically is not unusual, because in the teens and 20s, as electricity was added to houses that had not been built with it originally, they added two things that sometimes at the same time, an indoor bathroom and electricity. So that wasn't too unusual. So the unusual thing was that the bathroom was completely stacked solid with books. All the water had been shut off, and it was just stacked up with books. Said, so I had to take 2 men out. We had to unpack all the books, read the meter reading, and then he said, we stood there while Fitzpatrick watched, and we had to put all the books back. And he said, so
The next day, the electric company, at their own expense, moved his meter to the outside. But they also discovered that he wasn't using electricity. He had electricity, but he didn't use it. What did he light the house with? It's the same man who was afraid to light the furnace. He lit the house with kerosene lamps, clear up until the day he died. Next man I talked to was Ray Baller. He had the Champlin station there in downtown Bethany. And he laughed and he said, oh yeah. He said he would come down and get a little red wagon and a 1 gallon red kerosene can. And he would come down and he'd either come to my Champlin station or he'd go across the street to McCartney's garage and get a gallon of kerosene. So the night before he died, he came down and got a gallon of kerosene. He says, and when he got ready to go home, he said, you know, I don't feel very well. Could you give me a ride home? So he said, I gave him a ride home. And he said, I've still got to pull over the red wagon. So, lit it with kerosene. A neighbor across the street, whose name I don't remember, told me that one day he noticed Fitzpatrick was in his front yard. Not Fitzpatrick's, the man across the street, and he was picking up sticks. And he said, I went out to see what he was doing. He said he immediately grabbed the sticks and ran around back to his house. I walked over there, and he said he had accumulated whenever sticks would come, you'd pull them and put them in his backyard. He said if a tree fell down, he would get his Model T or a Zephyr, and he would drag the tree back into his backyard. He said at that point, he wouldn't talk to anybody. He was very secretive. Take those sticks home with him. He had an almost complete collection of sticks. Lillian died of tuberculosis in 1935. Mary, who was almost a decade older, she lived 3 years after she broke her hip with her sister in Iowa City. Interestingly, we find that after he died and we look back, that we find correspondence that Fitzpatrick had offered to sell his library to the University of Nebraska, the whole thing, everything, lock, stock, and barrel, the whole library, back in the 50s. For $3,000, but they turned it down. The scarcest items probably that didn't end up at the University of Kansas ended up at Harvard, Yale, and Princeton. Many of the books, I have been told, and I have not gone to Kansas City, but I have been told the Kansas City Library has deaccessioned most of them and has traded them for books for the collection, so they are not. The ones at the Spencer Library are literally all still there, because you may remember here 20 years ago when this book thief came through, all the university libraries and the stealing stuff, the Spencer Library got immediately very, 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 very careful. And when I went down, when Laura was in school down there, I went to the Spencer Library and told them what I was looking for, and some of the pictures you see went to the Spencer Library, and they let me copy them. If you go into the Spencer Library, and like any research library, you do not take in anything but a pencil and sheets of paper. You're met at the door by somebody, you tell them who you are, you give them identification, and that person is with you at your side all the time, period. You want a specific book, somebody else goes and gets it, they bring it, you sit at this table, you do your notes, this other guy is right there with you the whole time. Then the book is taken, put it away. So they're very, very careful. Well, this man that everybody dealt with all over the world and considered was a multimillionaire, his maximum salary at the University of Nebraska was $1,800 per year. His retirement income, $77.94 a month. And at the time of his death, he had cash on hand, that's cash laying on the desk and in the bank, a total of $11.62. Ran out of money. One of the things that he had was Patrick Gass's journal, the Gass Journal, it's called G-A-S-S. Patrick Gass was with Lewis and Clark, and actually published his journal before Lewis and Clark did. He published his in 1807. The University of Kansas has Fitzpatrick's first edition, and it's worth about $22,000 now. And his second edition, which they also have, is worth about $10,000. When Mary was interviewed by Town Journal magazine in their last issue, as a matter of fact, she was quoted as saying, "You might think it peculiar the way Teddy and I lived, but we never had an unhappy day, not an unhappy hour." Well, how did he do it? That's the good question. Well, he said he considered every book on every auction, every single book, and he looked at it. And he would put a minimum bid on every single book. So, you know, he might get a very, very tiny percentage, a small percentage, but when he did, he bought them right. And he said he admitted that he bought most of these things long before a real market existed. And he said for the Mormon items when he was at Graceland College, he paid usually between 6 and 13 cents. He traded. He was an inveterate trader, as I mentioned before. Mary, who lived out her days with her sister, were able to go back in and find her sister's estate papers. And her sister had inherited from their father several farms in Iowa. And it is my assumption that Mary probably also inherited several farms from their father, and that she probably converted into cash early on. And this became a source of income then to buy books. We think that probably things like the Jefferson and the Lincoln Library and the signers of the Constitution or the Declaration and so forth probably came by inheritance. We don't know that. We don't know. Probably never will know. Lillian finally did receive her doctorate at Columbia, where Fred ended up as well before she died. And towards the end of her life, she became friendly with the head of the Department of Psychiatry at Columbia University. And she went to him and said that she was, frankly, concerned for her mother and her well-being. And she wanted to know, you know, if the head of the psychiatry department could give her advice on how to get her mother away from her father. Quite frankly, she's just afraid for her. So the head of the psychiatric department at Columbia begins a correspondence with Thomas Jefferson Fitzpatrick. And his correspondence indicates that he determines from what Fitzpatrick says that Lillian is a little bit crazy. And they come within a hair's breadth of committing Lillian. But that doesn't happen either. So there is pretty much the whole story.
Yep. So there are no descendants?
Well, undoubtedly Fred had children. Lillian died before she married, and I've been unable to trace down. Fred would be gone now too, the son. And Fred, he and his father were estranged at the last. But he did become the executor of the estate. But he and his father were not speaking towards the end. And you can see why. And I think probably Lillian and Fred were both afraid for their mother's safety. Justifiably. He had slipped over that edge now between bibliophile, and a bibliophile is a person who is interested in books, paper, printing, everything to do with books, but a bibliomane, literally, that's all there is in their life. There is nothing else. And that's sort of where he got to. My kind of guy. Another question.
How did he function as a professional?
Well, he obviously did a pretty good job as a librarian. He was extremely well liked by the students. And he seemed to do okay. He taught very few classes other than his seminar over the summer. He was primarily acted as the director of the herbarium and as the librarian. And apparently when he taught classes, he was loved. But towards the end, I take it, he did not teach very much. So. How did he function? Adequately. Maybe barely. Being loved by the students is okay, but that's not necessarily going to get you anywhere. And of course, never having completed his doctorate, he never would have advanced to full professor. It has been done. Virginia Faulkner was a full professor, but didn't have a doctorate, for example. So it can happen, but not very often. It's not destined to. Anything else? Okay, Pat, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We hope you have enjoyed this podcast from Lincoln City Libraries. If you would like to comment on this or any of our podcasts, you can do so by visiting our podcast page at www.lincolnlibraries.org/podcasts.